Crime Curious is a true crime podcast that takes an in-depth look into real cases through the lens of a trained investigator and former prosecutor turned judge.
If you are sensitive to expletives, anatomical descriptions, and accurate descriptions of crime scenes, this podcast may not be suitable for you.
Have you or someone you love been a victim of a crime that's still unsolved? Crime Curious has teamed up with one of the top private investigation services in the Indiana and surrounding area. If you have listened to us long enough, you know that we do not seek out services or products that are meaningless to us or hold no real value. So you can trust us when we say that Corbett Investigations comes with decades of experience you won't find anyplace else. Corbett Investigations is run by a former homicide commander of one of the country's most successful homicide units, has put over 400 people in prison for homicide, handled over 1,100 death investigations, and solved 33 cold case murders. To be real with you, Mr. Corbett had a really difficult time telling us what we should highlight in this segment because he does not like to sound like he's bragging. Solving crimes has been his life's passion, and he has never done it for the accolades or recognition. He has a whole team behind his services that help him be so successful, as they specialize in things like bloodstain analysis, ballistics, crime scene reconstruction, and forensic pathology, just to name a few. When you contact Corbett Investigations, you talk directly with Tim Corbett. He is hands-on with every case and can travel anywhere that's needed to get the job done. Corbett Investigations prides itself on honesty, truth, feet-to-the-ground, real investigation work, and the strength to stand up to whatever is in the way of solving the crime. Corbett Investigations specializes in complex homicide cases, sex offenses, and criminal investigations that are old and new. Tim and his team have a reputation for finding witnesses and information that others could not. Although we hope none of our listeners ever need private investigation services, if you do, we recommend contacting Corbett Investigations and mention this segment on Crime Curious for a free consultation. Contact Tim Corbett today at 574-229-8115. You can also check them out on Facebook at Corbett Investigative Services, Inc. or their email, tim@tcorbett.org. That's tim@tcorbett.org. Thanks for listening, and now on to the show. Welcome to Crime Curious. I'm Charnel.
I'm Megan.
Megan's back.
She's back.
Let's shake all of our great.
She's back.
Oh, there's so much shaking happening. Hi,
there
Chaz.
Is. You've got Chaz. You've got the
this
crystals.
Is very full. The sack is very full.
It is. We have crystals from our friends over at Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of stuff in here, and I can tell that someone else has been handling my sack.
Can you feel Wes's energy on there?
I can. It's mm-hmm. sticky.
It is. Sticky is a great word
sticky,
for him.
It's sticky, energy. And I don't mean that grossly, of but feel not. Free to take it that way. Yeah. His energy in general is what
sticks.
I would lovingly describe as sticky.
Mm-hmm.
You can't help it.
To you.
He's Velcro.
The people know because they love him.
I know they do.
He has stuck to them as well.
I know. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I can't even be jealous because he's Wes.
Absolutely.
I can't even be like, oh, they like him more than me. So do I sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, he's... Yep. Fun.
He is.
And he did a great job. I listened to both of those. You know I'm a
did
fan,
I
so
know.
I listened to the episodes.
You know I'm a fan.
I know.
I think if you ever recorded an episode without me, I would 100% listen. I don't listen to our episodes. After they're done edited, I never listen to them again, unless some of the brain bath really funny ones if I need to be in a good mood.
First of all,
will,
you'd have to show me how the equipment works, and second, I feel like it'd be a science experiment. Okay, Charnel, go outside now. I'm going to record one of these with Wes or with Jason, and then you come back.
Yes. Oh, that's fine. We should do that sometime.
It might
oh,
be fun.
Oh, gosh. All right. So I have a murder for you today.
I figured you did. Mm-hmm. You're not going to let me down easy.
No.
Or let me off easy on my way
back
from paradise.
From vacation. No, no. This was actually requested by several people. So thank you, everybody, for this one. Let's talk a little bit about Jennifer before we get into some of the other nitty-gritty here. She grew up in Bishop, Texas on a farm. This was a very small, Bishop's a small town, about 3,000 people. It's about 40 miles from the Texas coast, just your regular American blue-collar town. Jennifer was described as being a child. She was not a prissy girl. She was a farm girl. She liked being dirty. She liked being outside. She liked really liked helping to take care of the animals. They had a pig farm. Okay.
Wow.
I know.
Does that feel familiar
yes,
to you?
Yes, it did. When I started researching this, I'm like, okay, all right, Jennifer, I see you. Yep. And she had three other siblings. She was a middle child. And as a good Texas town, you know, she liked to go to the football games on Friday night. Yeah. It's a small school system, so everyone knew your siblings growing up. Jennifer really liked to read. She would actually read to her sister Lauren every night and helped Lauren learn how to read. She was described as being very funny. She did not like the spotlight to be on her. She often would just let her siblings decide, like, just go with the flow. All right,
see,
what do
now
you want to do?
She just deviated from you and me.
A little bit, yeah. But I'm the baby. That. I'm not the middle child.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm the oldest.
Mm-hmm. She was described as being the peacekeeper amongst the siblings.
As
so.
Middle children are, hint, my husband.
Yep. This is a very important piece, I think, when you talk about later behavior patterns and personality characteristics, even from a young age. She was the type of person who just really was attracted to anything, animal or human, that needed a little extra help, needed some TLC. TLC.
Sometimes you need TSC too.
Yeah.
They have the little chickens in the feeders ready to go.
Dude, they're a farm store around here.
It was weirdly Freudian.
It really was.
In a farm girl, not sexual way.
Absolutely. It absolutely was. So during her childhood, Jennifer's parents did get divorced. I'll tell you a little bit about her dad because I think, just given my background and your background, we might see some of those genetics come to play here. But Charlie Cave was unfortunately an alcoholic. He suffered from alcoholism, and after the divorce he really just didn't make a big effort to be a father, but Jennifer always wanted to make sure that he was okay. Like she would ask her mom frequently to make sure that her mom was checking up on her dad, which was so not her mom's responsibility anymore.
They
but a
divorced.
Child doesn't understand that, right? Her mom actually gave an interview and was talking about how they were, a hurricane was coming. And Jennifer really wanted to make sure that her mom would go over and make sure that her dad was all like prepared for the hurricane, which of course her mom doesn't want to tell her, like, that's really not my problem, you know. But so there was just, that's
it,
how
it
big
explains,
her heart is.
It explains the divorce though. If this was the type of relationship that they had where mom was clearly taking care of dad and then they divorced, so she was worried and became the mommy wife protector for dad.
Yeah, like who's going to take care
who's
of
gonna
dad
take care
now
because
mom did it. Mm-hmm. So Sharon actually gets another partner. His name is Jim. And they had this theory. They called it the stray dog theory. And in terms of Jennifer, they just felt like she always took in and attracted stray dogs.
Oh, my God. I know her.
Yeah.
It's
right?
Not me, by the way.
Yeah. I know. It.
I've taken in a stray, but I'm happy to let them back out.
Yep. After the divorce, Jennifer and her family moved to Corpus Christi, Texas. And Jennifer actually graduated from Mary Carroll High School in 2002. She would be my exact age. Later that year, she moved to San Marcos, Texas, and attended Texas State University as a finance major. She did struggle here. She got into the party lifestyle, alcohol.
It happens.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol really started to take hold. She did some experimentation with drugs. And so after one semester, she did leave school.
Okay.
Because it was just too much of a struggle with her partying and things like that. So now I'm going to enter a man named Colton Aaron Pitaniak. He grew up in Bryant, Arkansas. He was described as exceptionally smart. This kid, it's just such a shame, by the way, of what he makes of his life, because when you research him, besides the terrible deeds that he ends up doing, you will also find information about how brilliant he was and how what he could have made of himself.
We've presented on brilliant killers before.
And there's some crude articles that talk about him being an altar boy, but he grew up in a Catholic high school, an all boys.
Sure,
school.
And the media will use sarcasm one will.
They will.
And say veritable altar boy.
He was
commits
described,
heinous crime.
Yes, he was described as an altar boy with a dark side.
Yeah.
Well, you know what was going on in some of those churches. I understand.
Was it Brainbath Jason, an altar boy?
That explains so much.
I see it.
I think he was. I think he was, Megan. Whoops. Sorry, I just knocked over. I went to reach for the comfort sack.
I know, we do that. I didn't know if you guys realized that.
Knocked something over. Sorry about that if you heard it. I'm not going to be able to edit it out. So it is what it is. But anyway, Colton. So he was described as having an obsession with movies like Scarface. And what was that main character? Like, is it Tony Montana? Something like that. He wanted to be a gangster. Okay.
The Godfather and
yes.
all of this is his jam. Mm-hmm. Scarface, the Godfather.
Yes. He was also described as being a white supremacist. Very racist.
That's just rude because not all mobsters were white supremacists at all. In fact, the Italians were very often considered to be of a lower race.
Yes.
So
no,
this guy had his, for a smart guy, he mm-hmm. mixed up a lot of his history.
He did. And it's funny that you say that because I was like, I'm really surprised by this considering how extremely book smart he was. You'd think he'd be more open, but I guess not. He earned a scholarship to
Hitler.
Good point.
Smart guy.
Right.
Used his mind for bad things.
So bad. He earned a scholarship to the University of Texas at Austin upon graduating high school, and he attended UT in 2001. And, you know, he joined the Delta Tau Delta fraternity soon after joining going to school. Now, you would think that maybe the fraternity could help level him out a little bit. But it did not bring out the best version of himself, okay? Instead, it seemed to project him even farther into this Scarface fantasy gangster-esque persona.
Dude, grow up.
Yeah, no, he was actually regressing.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. So he's not just dealing the drugs, okay? He's also using them as well, which eventually leads to his own addiction. In early 2003, Colton was arrested for driving under the influence. This did not scare him into change at all. Instead, he decided that this probably just made him cooler amongst his peers. It made him more gangster-like. So he would go, after his arrest, he would go to his frat house and just frequently talk about his stint in jail and all of this stuff. And this
dude, you spent two nights in jail for drunk driving.
Right.
Don't pretend that you're a ghetto thug.
Yep, but this made all of the other frat boys very uncomfortable.
Probably.
They kicked him out.
Good. See, this continues to give me faith in some of the fraternal organizations. Mm-hmm. My son happens to be part of one, and I'm very impressed with how they handle these type of situations. Yeah. Not all of them do.
No.
This is a good ending for that fraternity.
Yes.
They can look back at this reject and be like, oh, no. We kicked him out.
Absolutely. Way to follow our policies, guidelines, and intuition here.
Yeah.
Because this is why. As a result, he moved into his own place, which became what was described as a drug hovel. Eventually, University of Texas suspended him, and he started taking classes at Austin Community College the following spring.
Okay.
So as I mentioned before, we left you when we were last talking about Jennifer. We left with how she was struggling. She had dropped out of school and had began drinking, doing drugs, that sort of thing. Now her mom Sharon was very worried about her at this time, but of course she's 3 hours away, so she's not close to home, and Jennifer is insisting that she's okay. All right, she had an apartment, she had a stray cat, she had a boyfriend named Mark until Mark broke up with her. And on that same day that Mark broke up with her, Jennifer arrived to, she had been working at a really upscale steakhouse restaurant as a waitress. And the day that Mark broke up with her, she arrived at work, obviously high. And so they fired her on the spot. And it's unfortunately around this time where she's no longer attending college. She's partying too much. She gets fired. Her boyfriend breaks up with her. that her and Colton's paths cross for the first time.
Of course they do.
I know. Colton had already flunked several of his classes now at community college, which I told you how brilliant he was. He got scholarships, man.
He's got addiction issues now, though.
Yes, he can't pass his community college classes. So, and it was because he was on a lengthy drug bender. So him and Jennifer meet at a party, and for Jennifer, she was just meeting another dude. But for Colton, he was like meeting the girl of his dreams.
Okay.
He falls hard for her.
And fast.
Yes. And she does not reciprocate those feelings. She friend zones him very quickly.
So they had hooked up?
Nope.
Okay. No. They had just met. She immediately has friend zoned him. Mm-hmm. And he is interested.
He is. And I can't speak to whether or not there was ever an intimate relationship. I didn't go seeking that information.
It wouldn't have mattered anyway.
No. And I do know that they did like to use together as mm-hmm. well. I think that Jennifer kind of initially saw Colton as a way to her drugs.
Yeah.
Okay. To meet her addiction needs.
She met a dealer. Mm-hmm. He met a girl.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the same.
And remember, she likes to collect stray dogs and try to rehabilitate them. Okay. Right. Give them a safe place.
So she found an old lab.
Yes. Yep. And
or a St. Bernard, but instead of a barrel of alcohol, it was meth.
It was meth. Yes. And they were friends. They stayed that way for 2 years, although Colton was very adamant that he wanted, at every turn that he could, he let her know that he wanted to be more than friends. Now, Jennifer was very close with her mom. They talked all the time, sometimes multiple times a day. And Sharon, her mother, recalled that she knows Jennifer felt really sorry for Colton a lot. She would call and tell her mom, like, oh, Colton got picked up for his, DUI. Oh, Colton got in trouble again. Now, Sharon does not love that her daughter, who is an adult, she can't do a whole lot about this, is not hanging out with the best people. And not all the people in her life, of course, are negative influences at this time. But this one sticks out. Colton sticks out. But one thing that Sharon always knows about her is she always collects these stray people in her life that need help and thinks that she can help them. So that's how she just saw her and Colton's relationship at that point in time. But however, the two did go more than a week without talking, and she was with Colton that whole time. And so Sharon immediately does not like that Colton seems to be keeping her from her ordinary routines of staying connected with her family. And this time was described, but I don't know because I wasn't there, of them being kind of on a drug bender together. Okay. Yeah.
That's what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Colton was described by friends as being obsessed. They used that word. He would take her on, quote, dates and give her all the drugs, and she would...
aren't dates.
They're not. And he wouldn't ask for anything in return except for time with him. He was trying to groom her into a relationship, right?
And she's not completely unaware of this. Mm-mm. And is happy to give him her time for drugs.
Yes. Yep. And they were described as being friends. They enjoyed one another's company. She friend-zoned him, but she wanted to have other relationships, okay? Now, bystanders at this time in their life could see that this relationship was unhealthy, okay? But there were times where there were fights. There were times where they weren't getting along. They were just kind of like get to this point where it's like on again, off again friendship. But Jen was described as someone who gives people a lot of chances. Then in 2004, Colton is arrested for drug possession. This was a bizarre story, Megan. He's actually arrested. He does too many drugs. Becomes paranoid, calls 911 himself.
Do you know how many times I've seen this happen?
I bet it happens a lot.
Yeah. I used to have, sometimes people would call the police in a state of paranoia because someone stole their illegal drugs. I wish I could say that was just something I read online, but
right,
it's true.
But it happens.
They're like, yeah. I'm sorry, he stole how much heroin from you?
Mm-hmm. How much did you have in your possession?
Two bindles.
Oh.
Well, that's got to be worth what? $150
My God. No, people. So he does that. Colton does that. He calls 911 in his paranoid state out of fear. He was fearing something. Police come to his apartment and out in the open. This was not a search, Megan, just out in the open. They have Ambien, Xanax, and other prescription drugs that were sitting out in plain view that were not prescribed to him. Now, naturally, the officers arrest him for possession of a controlled substance, which
is a number of them.
Mm-hmm, a Class A felony, as compared to the Class C misdemeanors that he had had previous to this. All right. And toward the end of 2004, Jennifer starts dating a man named Scott. Now, Scott actually is a single dad who battled his own addiction and was willing to help her overcome hers, but he sets firm boundaries that drugs were not allowed around his daughter, and if she started using drugs again, their relationship would be over because he can't risk his sobriety and his daughter as
right.
well. Okay? So if she wanted to, they get very close, and if she wanted to move in, these were the terms, all right? By the start of 2005, Jennifer has cut all ties with Colton and she is not using drugs. Things are really looking up for her.
That's great.
Colton starts dating a law student named Laura Hall.
What the hell is wrong with you, Laura?
I don't.
You can do better, Laura.
You're being very careful right now.
Well, I am because, and you know, whatever. Fuck Laura. She's involved in this
too. Oh, okay. Fuck Laura then.
Yeah. What I found was just like people said they were in a relationship, but what I found more is really that they were fuck buddies.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, whatever.
So he found a hookup buddy. Was she screwing him for drugs too?
Well, not at first, but he introduced her. I mean, he is a dealer.
Yeah.
He introduced her to drugs. So she does start using.
He can get women to stick around for quite a long time once they're addicted.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Laura thought that they were in like a monogamous relationship. Colton thought that they were just messing around. So he still had other girls on the side. So their relationship, not healthy.
He should know how that feels, though, being the person who was not an object of love from his desired.
Right. Laura obviously despises Jennifer right from the start.
Okay.
The first time she hears Colton talk about her friend. Now, remember, at this point in time, they're not hanging out, okay? But Colton talks about her.
Yeah.
You know, they had this friendship that they shared. Laura knew, and all of their friend group confirms this, that Laura knew that Jennifer was not interested in Colton, that she was only interested in friendship. They would, you know, there is no reason why Laura needs to see Jennifer as a romantic rival. But it didn't matter. Okay. It did not matter that Jennifer had not been interested in her or anything, because essentially I think Laura was just insecure. And so if you hear another woman's name, and like I said, Colton was obsessed with her. So, you know, he's saying her name differently than other girls' names, right? You can, as a woman, you can pick up on that energy. You know what it means, right?
For sure.
Colton does spend the next 7 months emotionally manipulating Jennifer, calling her all the time, leaning on her for everything. Now, Jennifer, remember, collects stray dogs. So she is not hanging out with him anymore. She's not using drugs anymore, but she is taking his calls. In June 2005, because remember, end of 2004, he gets picked up on this felony charge. He goes to trial for his drug possession charge. And his defense claimed that the search that had led to the drugs was illegal, which was not true. Okay, the prescription, he invited the police. He called 911 into his home. He invited the police into his home, and they were sitting out, all right, in the open.
Yes.
So the jury actually sentenced him to 60 days in prison, and he got out in 20 for good behavior.
60 days?
Yep.
Oh.
60 days.
He just had to spend 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
But he didn't. He didn't even spend a month. He got out in 20 days for good behavior.
It happens.
So around this time, Jennifer and Scott, they're not having the most copacetic relationship at this point in time. She's just not sure that she's ready to like be plugged into the family life with a daughter and a dude. And she really wanted to get on her own feet. She didn't like depending on him financially, because at this point in time, you know, to get clean and whatnot, she was living with him and depending on him financially, and she didn't like that. She wanted to just be on her own 2 feet. So she's applying for jobs. She's really trying to pick herself up. When Colton is released from prison, Jen's friends warned her, stay away from him, do not answer any of his calls, any of this stuff. Well, of course, that doesn't happen. Colton wiggles his way back into Jennifer's life. And at this point in time, Jennifer amicably breaks things off with Scott. All right. And Scott actually at this time thought that their breakup would really just be temporary because Jennifer still wanted to stay in his daughter's life. Like she didn't want to negatively affect his daughter in that way of just being gone all of a sudden. So he just kind of thought once she gets on her own two feet and feels that independent, knows that she can be independent, we'll be okay. We'll probably be back together. So Jennifer moves in with a new roommate named Denise Winterbottom. I just love that last name for some reason.
Winterbottom.
And so she moves in with Denise without Scott's constant presence and sobriety. She does relapse again. So now, of course, her and Colton are hanging out together more than they were before, which is not good. So I'm going to take you, we're going to go to a timeline now.
That keep your drugs close and your dealer closer?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I think with him constantly calling, after he got released from prison, he bullied his way back into her life because he's obsessed with her, right? So that constant, here you are, you broke up from Scott, you're living with Denise, and you have this constant trigger, this constant guy who you used to use drugs with.
Oh, I
and
know.
You're not stable in your sobriety yet. It's been less than a year. Okay.
People, so, places,
yeah.
and things.
Yeah.
Those of you who are in recovery and know this, and those of you that aren't, it's one of the primary things they talk about when you are going through therapeutic substance abuse counseling.
Yes.
Is to be cognizant of the people you are around, the places that you are, and the things that are around you, mm-hmm. all of which can and will be triggers.
Yes.
She never took care of her people, places, and things.
Yep. And so when she moves in with Denise, she does get triggered because she continues to take calls from Colton. And it's all of those. It's all those triggers. So let's go to January 16th, 2005, and I'm going to kind of break things down in a timeline for us. Jennifer interviewed and got a new job as an administrative assistant at a law firm.
Ooh, interesting.
Yes. She was super excited about that. She had called her mom, was telling her mom how excited she was to start this job. On August 16th, 2005, she and Denise watched a Lifetime movie together that night. And when it was over, Jen got her outfit ready for the next day, asked Denise, like, hey, make sure I'm up at 6:30, you know, don't let me sleep in, like that kind of thing. And she's just very excited to start her new job. Same night, August 16th, 2005, at 10:30 p.m., Colton calls Jennifer, inviting her out for a few drinks to celebrate her new job. She doesn't want to. She's trying to tell him no. He's insistent, and she does then agree. All right. That's on her. She did agree.
Yeah, but okay. She was pressured.
She was.
Manipulated.
She was.
Excuse me, manipulated.
And I'm sure that he was, you know, woe is me. I mean, God, the manipulation tactics are, we don't know how strong those can be.
They clearly have a really unhealthy codependent relationship. Absolutely. As is often with substance abuse anyway. But mm-hmm. even despite that, substance abuse, not a healthy relationship for either of them. Mm-mm. He's in love with her and she is not interested in him. And it's just going to blow up.
Yep. Colton at this point in time is very erratic. He is going wildly between he wants to get his life together and he wants to continue to be a gangster drug dealer.
It's really hard to make. You can't have them both.
Sure can't. So August 17th, 2005 at 12 a.m. Okay, so they go out for drinks at 10:30. Now we're at 12 a.m. Colton and Jennifer broke off from the group of friends that were with them at the restaurant. At 1 a.m. August 17th, Jennifer called her friend Michael, who, upon hearing that she was with Colton, tried to convince her to go home. But Jen insisted that she was okay. And this is the last time that anyone hears from her. 1 a.m. August 17th, 6:30 a.m. Denise hears Jennifer's alarm going off and figures she's going to be up in a few minutes to get ready for her first day. However, when Denise gets out of the shower and still hears Jennifer's alarm going off, she knocks on the door, peeks inside, and realizes that Jennifer is not there. So she's like, okay, that's weird, but maybe she stayed out with someone, stayed at someone's house, okay? August 17th, 8:30 a.m., Jen's new boss notices that she hasn't arrived yet. After a little while, you know, he does try to call her.
Sure.
Okay.
This person's supposed to start their first day. They haven't appeared. I'd call too, possibly because I was wondering if they decided not to accept the job.
Absolutely. And now I have to repost it.
But irrespective, yep. He mm-hmm. made the phone call. Mm-hmm.
After a while, when he is still not getting a hold of her, he ultimately gets in touch with Sharon Cave, her mother. All right. Mm-hmm. And just says like, hey, I'm sure that he was probably like an emergency contact on paperwork that she filled out, things like that. Immediately Sharon knows something's wrong because she's like, first of all, she wouldn't just not show up for a first day of work like that. No matter what her substance abuse struggles were, she showed up for work when she had a job.
Everything that you've told me so far makes me believe that.
Yeah. So now, granted, she did get fired for these things. Because
she showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
That's exactly it.
Again.
Because she showed up.
She showed up.
Yes. So this is why Sharon is like, oh no, oh no. And she had talked to her and knew she was so excited about this job.
But mom also knows that mm-hmm. she has a tendency to hang out with Colton.
Right. At this point in time, and when you do, if you decide to do your own research on this, you will hear people refer to Sharon as Sharon Sedgwick. She is Sharon Sedgwick now, but at this point in time, her longtime partner, Jim Sedgwick, they were not married, but he did help raise the girl, you know, her kids, okay? But at this point in time in their life, they were not married. So they did everything that a parent should do, you guys. They called the police stations, they called the morgues, they called the hospitals, they called all the friends. Then, and of course, still kept trying to get a hold of Jennifer. She talked to Denise Winterbottom. Denise told the story about how, hey, it was weird because she had her outfit planned. Everything was all set. She had her alarm set. She wasn't there this morning for her alarm.
Who called Colton?
Hold on. We get to that. Because mom doesn't just have those numbers readily available. What mom does is smartly, she has Jennifer on her phone plan. So she can just go right down to the phone company, get a printout of all the last people that Jennifer's number had called and been in contact with. All right. The police would not initially let her file a missing persons report, of course, because it had only been a matter of hours. She is a 21-year-old woman, right? So they don't consider her a missing person. Nope. So this led Sharon and Jim to do their own investigation. Their own investigation. So she does. She gets a hold of the phone bill, starts calling all the last people that Jennifer had contact with. Colton Petaniak would not answer his phone. She gets a hold of Michael. Remember, she talked to Michael Rodriguez at 1 o'clock in the morning. And when Michael found out that she was with Colton, he tried to get her to go home. Michael was actually a DJ that she had just met a few weeks before, and he answers his phone and he tells her mom all of that. And so Michael's like, yes, I talked to Jennifer. This is what, you know, what we were talking about. And this is what the interesting story is. So Michael's on mom's cell phone.
Yes.
But she also gets a hold of, and I don't know if Colton had called her back or if she just kept him on the cell phone and then decided to try Colton another time, but she gets Colton on her work phone. She's at work. And so Michael can hear everything that Colton is saying.
Ooh.
Okay. And he blatantly lies and tells Sharon that he has not talked to her or seen Jennifer or anything. And Michael is over there on the other line going, false, liar, liar, pants on fire, because at 1 o'clock in the morning, she told me that she was with him and I was trying to get her to go home because I didn't like her being with him. Obviously now Colton's very much on mom's radar.
Oh yeah.
Okay. And then he then insists, you know what? I saw her downtown. We met for dinner and drinks at 10:30. And then at midnight, remember at midnight when they broke off from the group?
Yes.
He says, nope, that's when she broke off from me and I didn't see her again.
But we know that's not true because of the 1:30.
The 1 o'clock phone call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sharon's trying to make sense of all this. She, throughout the course of this day, August 17th, she is continuing to just, you know, she calls Colton back like, okay, have you heard from her yet? Now he's a little asshole and says, I'm eating pizza with my friends and you need to leave me alone. And then he refuses any other phone contact after that.
What a concerned friend mm-hmm. he is, Colton. Yep. This is out of character for somebody who loves somebody so much. You would think that he would be incredibly concerned.
Worried, let me help look for her. Yep.
Oh, no, my God, I'll make that. Phone calls.
None of that.
Yeah. I remember her walking away in a dark alley with an unknown stranger. Mm-hmm. I mean, Colton, you didn't even make up a good lie, man.
No, you're just trying to say, and people saw you leave meeting with
pizza.
Her. Yep. Nope. I'm eating pizza. You need to leave me alone. Stop calling me. And then he stopped answering their phone calls. Sharon and Jim are on their way to meet because they live in Corpus Christi.
Yes. Okay.
So they are on their way. They're about 3 hours away. They get to the town and they discover Jennifer's car is sitting outside of Colton's apartment at the Orange Tree Apartments.
Oh, hell.
So they call the police.
Like, he didn't figure this was going to get discovered. Like, what? Dumb shit. Her car is in front of your face.
Yeah. So they call the police again. And we're like, hey, you know, because they had already tried to call and report her as a missing person. So they call again, like, we are here now. And her car is sitting outside this person's apartment. Officer Hector, she's a female, is the one that responds. She takes the phone numbers from Sharon. Like, let me try to call these people. She calls Michael Rodriguez. She calls Scott Engel, actually, her ex-boyfriend.
Oh, yeah, with
Scott.
The little girl. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Colton is the only one that will not take the officer's phone call.
Well, when it comes through whatever county sheriff's office or court system, mm-hmm. just in my experience, they tend not to answer.
They don't like to answer.
And then you get a call from an unknown number later that says, did somebody try to call me from here? And well, who are you? And I'll let you know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And also turn yourself in on your warrant, Michael. I know it was you.
No, it's you. So the officer does, you know, respond to the apartments. She does see Jennifer's car outside. She knocks on the door. It's number 88, as a matter of fact. No one answers. She leaves her card wedged in the apartment door, and there's really nothing more that she can do at this point, as you know.
He is a person of interest.
Mm-hmm. So Sharon and Jim, and they admit now that they shouldn't have done this, but I cannot judge them. Honestly, like, I don't know what I would have done in this situation, Megan. They take Jennifer's car to the hotel where they're going to stay because they're thinking she's going to come back and she's going to call them and say, oh my God, someone stole my car. And that's how they're going to get her to get into contact with them because they have not considered an alternative hypothesis at this point in time. Okay. They're still holding on to hope that she's just
their parent brains mm-hmm. aren't going to acknowledge mm-hmm. that she could be dead.
Correct.
Yeah. There were some other options there, but the police aren't getting involved. I'm going to want it processed like a crime scene immediately. So I'm going to know better than to take it, but I'm not a normal parent. Neither
right.
are you.
Right.
I don't know what a normal parent would do. I might grab a fucking lawn chair and a six pack and sit there by the tree and wait for somebody to come to that goddamn car though.
Oh, don't worry. They go there. They get there. They get to that
okay,
point.
Okay. So that makes sense to me as a parent. Mm-hmm. Can yep. you see, I can see the four of us now, if one of our kids went missing, sitting by that vehicle
absolutely.
With lawn chairs, six packs and shotguns.
Yes.
Not that I would have the shotgun in possession with alcohol. My husband would have the shotgun
and you would
that
have
he
the
can
alcohol.
Legally carry and I would have the alcohol.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
yeah, I want to know what happened to my goddamn baby.
Absolutely. Yep. So she even gets a hold of Colton's dad, Eddie Petaniak.
Love that.
And Eddie's
I'm
like,
I'm going to call your parents.
Yes. And Eddie's like, I have not seen the kids. I haven't talked to them. I don't know where they are. So it's late afternoon, evening of August 17th. They put Jennifer's car back in front of the Orange Tree Apartments. And this is where they sit and lay and wait. Okay. At this
Sometimes
point in
I
time.
I just know things.
Yes, I know. I love it. At this point in time, Jennifer's sister Vanessa joined Jim and Sharon in the hunt. Okay. They called the police again and the police did come out again. And they're very adamant about how nice these police are. And I know it was very frustrating for them at the beginning that like they wouldn't, you know, do anything, but they couldn't. They understand that now, but in the moment it was very frustrating, but they did reiterate how kind the police officers were. And so this officer was very nice, but was looking for a manager of the apartment to be on site. And there wasn't anyone available. And he explained to them, I don't have probable cause to break into this apartment. I can't get in there right now.
No, you need a search warrant.
Yep.
And to get a search warrant, as Charnel just indicated, you need PC.
You do. But he was willing at this point in time to officially classify her as a missing person. So they were able to fill out that paperwork and get that going.
It's been over 24 hours. Or close to it.
Close to it. It's the evening. It is like the evening. Yep.
Getting
evening
close hours. To the last time mm-hmm. she was seen.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
So it's nighttime. They're still waiting outside door 88. No one has come and gone. And Sharon notices a small broken piece of glass in one of the windows. So Jim uses his broken sunglasses, a piece from his broken sunglasses in his car, to get the window unlatched. And Jim goes in through the window. I told you, when I say they did their own investigation, you guys, I mean they did their own investigation.
I'm sitting over here not being judgmental.
I know. And Jim at first was just calling out like, hey, I'm here. I'm not, you know, don't shoot. I'm not here to hurt you. I'm just looking for Jennifer. He's yelling. There is no response. He stood there to make sure that someone wasn't going to jump out at him. And he described how he had to crawl over a couch and he's looking around this living room. And he finds Jennifer in the bathtub.
Uh-huh.
And we'll get to how he found her.
Just so you guys know, my face is all covered up because I've been waiting. I've been waiting.
And you guys need to know that this is gruesome. We have a very gruesome crime scene, so prepare yourself.
Trigger alert.
Trigger alert, for sure. But he yells to Sharon and Vanessa to call 911 immediately, and he would not let Vanessa or Sharon go into the apartment. Thank God.
Okay.
Thank God. He was able to recognize that it was Jennifer by the freckles on her feet.
That's it.
Detective Hector, who I'd mentioned earlier, got a call from her commander at 12:30 a.m. to let them know, hey, remember that missing person that you know we're doing some work on? Well, we have found her, and it's horrifying. So he described for Detective Hector that there was a female body. Her head and her hands were missing. She was propped up in the bathtub facing the doorway. There was a hacksaw laying on her abdomen chest with flesh and blood on it. It was obvious that this is the tool that was used to partially dismember her. And on the garbage bag on the floor contained her head and hands.
Yeah, he was spending his day trying to get rid of the evidence.
Someone was. Mm-hmm.
Well, whose apartment was it?
Well, it was his, but there's okay. more. So an autopsy determined, and this is gruesome too, you guys. What happened to her after death is just unimaginable. An autopsy determined that the cause of death was a gunshot wound that traveled through her arm first, then went through her ribs, through the lower area of her right lung, and then went through her aorta. So the
injury, did she die immediately?
Yes, the injury was fatal, but that isn't where it stops.
I know, okay? But can mm-hmm. I just say that you always give me a small level of comfort when I know something ended
so
quickly.
Horrifically? Yes, yes. Nope, it was quickly. It went into her heart through her aortic.
But the rest of this is going to be a trigger.
It is.
A huge one.
It is. She had been stabbed 18 times in the face and several other places throughout her body. This, to me, is the most gruesome detail, and I'm not sure that we've actually even had something this disgusting. There was a bullet in her left temple, Megan, but there was no entry wound to that bullet. After her head had been dismembered, somebody shot up the neck portion and shot into her skull after her head was detached from her body.
Oh, I know who did this.
Me too. But we'll get, that doesn't,
I'm going to leave it alone.
I know exactly what you're thinking. It's exactly what we are communicating telepathically, and it really ticks me off the way things go down. Experts later determined that, as I said, you know, someone had shot the bullet into her detached neck just to kind of prove this point, right? Now, Colton had been the last person to see Jennifer alive, so he's immediately the first suspect. But his car is still parked outside of the apartment. So they don't know what vehicle Colton is in driving. Well, it turns out he was fleeing to Mexico.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And they find that out because...
In whose car?
Miss Laura Hall.
I was waiting for the girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they are fleeing.
They're fleeing. And how they know that he's going to the Texas-Mexico border is because he's using his cell phone and it's pinging off of towers.
What an idiot.
His phone records reflect that he first contacted Miss Hall via text message just after 3:30 a.m. on August 17th. And again, a 13-minute phone call at 6 a.m. That afternoon, he went to a hardware store and he purchased a hacksaw, garbage bags, cleaning products, rubber gloves. Around that same time, Laura Hall drove her green Cadillac to a gas station where she filled the tank and washed the car. Because, you know, in a runaway, you want to have a clean car.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe evidence. Do we know where she was shot and killed before the attempted dismembership?
Dismemberment.
Is it possible that she was shot in or near that vehicle?
I don't
or
know.
Or someplace else. It would explain why one would wash a car, just throwing that out
there. It is.
There.
It is. That doesn't, I agree.
Her parents cock-blocked them by showing up. They weren't able to finish cutting her up to dispose of her.
Because they showed up early in the day and were pounding on the door. Then the police were pounding on the door.
So they decided to head to Mexico and abandoned her corpse.
They did. And I suspect that they chose the time to flee in Laura's car when Sharon and Jim had taken Jennifer's car back to the hotel with them. Because no one saw them leave that apartment.
Yes.
So that's what I suspect. I don't know that for
sure. No, I'm 100% sure that's the right timing. It has to be.
On August 18th, Colton and Laura arrive in Mexico. They stayed at a Holiday Inn in Piedras Negras, which is just over the Rio Grande, all right, from Eagle Pass, Texas. Then, wonderfully, 5 days, it did take 5 days, but 5 days later, on August 23rd, 2005, a Mexican SWAT team surrounds the hotel and captures them both.
It's a weird thing about extradition, you see. People think that if you commit murder, you can just quick on cross over the border to Canada or Mexico, and they're just going to be like, you're free.
They forget about you.
They don't. Mm-hmm. And we do have international treaties as well. Now, is it harder to find you in Mexico or in the Canadian wilderness? Yes, it is.
But it doesn't mean they can't.
But it doesn't mean they can't. And again, what kind of idiots? They've watched too many movies. Mm-hmm. Goes right over the border and immediately stays in a hotel near the border and in town. You got to get yourself, not that I want to give you all advice to commit crimes, but down to the middle of nowhere, Mexico.
Right. Well, he hadn't watched enough Scarface, I guess.
Well, he did, but also not necessarily realistic.
No.
I keep forgetting about the Scarface reference. Yeah. This guy is larger than life and conceited and
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He's a punk. Officials drove over the border. Okay. They arrest him on suspicion of murder. They take him back to the States. And Laura was actually not immediately apprehended. They bring her back to the States, but they don't keep her. Especially because she told anybody who would listen that they weren't fugitives. They were just on vacation. Like, why are you arresting him? We're on vacation here in Mexico. Like, playing dumb. Like, I have no idea that my boyfriend dismembered somebody's body and is on the run.
She is a law student who has no criminal history, who probably is this good girl and can speak well. Yeah. And why wouldn't you be convincing that one was on vacation?
Mm-hmm. Colton claims that he doesn't remember shooting Jennifer, but that he may have done so because he'd been struggling with substance abuse for several years and was on the tail end of a several-day-long bender by the time that him and Jennifer met up on the night of August 16th.
Oh, this asshole's going to go with lack of memory, and yes, I might have shot her.
Yep, he says that at some point after midnight early on August 17th, he passed out, and when he woke, he found Jennifer's body in the bathtub. So he panicked and he called Laura Hall.
Oh, Laura wasn't there?
Uh-huh. Well, Laura wasn't there. Laura, so you panic and call your girlfriend and like, oh my gosh, the girl that you hate is dead in the bathtub? And you just rush over?
This is a bunch of bull.
He claims that it was Laura Hall who came up with the plan to dismember Jennifer's body. Colton said that it was Laura who made the list of items that they would need to complete the job. I mean, I could see her being more of the brains. He bought the items. He testified that he did not cut up the body. He claimed that it was Hall's idea to do that. And
I kind of believe that.
Mm-hmm. And it was her idea to flee to Mexico.
You know, it's in alignment that if he was in love with her, as he was with Jennifer, that he would commit a crime in the heat of passion, or perhaps maybe he was attempting to sexually assault her and she fought.
I think he wanted to hook up with her and he shot her. She would not. Mm-hmm.
And then...
And probably on drugs. Absolutely.
But I don't see somebody who has, without having committed those type of crimes before or having some type of psychosis that we're not aware of or diagnoses, I should say, seeing him cut her up. That's a very intense thing to do. So he called her because she had such a hatred.
Absolutely.
That dismembering someone you hate was nothing to her. And then firing a shot. Up
the skull,
severed head into the skull,
stabbing the face,
multiple times.
That has woman jealousy of the way that she looked. And yes, Jennifer was beautiful,
of course.
So that has Laura's name written all over it to me. However, I will say,
what are the chances Laura walked in on them doing something?
Very possible. We'll never freaking know, because it's not like these two jackweeds are going to give the truth ever.
No, he's going with voluntary intoxication as a defense, which it's not, by the way. Court rule, like literal jury instruction. Voluntary intoxication, not a defense. Involuntary intoxication is, by the way.
Okay.
If someone drugs you.
Right, right.
Which I also hear sense. Often.
Mm-hmm. No, he wasn't claiming that. He was just like, yeah, don't I remember. Was on a bender, right? Yeah. But I'll say this too, as much as I'm saying the stabbing in the face was potentially Laura, it also could have been Colton for being pissed off that she would not have a relationship with him.
I know it's sensitive, but was there any evidence of a sexual assault?
No.
Was there any evidence of any type of sexual activity?
Not that I saw.
Okay.
Mm-mm, not that I saw. Laura Hall didn't testify during her trial, but her attorney, Joe Sawyer, painted a completely different picture for the jury. All right.
Oh, I can see
so
this.
So Laura's defense is that the only thing that she was guilty of, it was loving Colton Petaniak too much, that she was irrational. She blindly committed herself to protecting him from harm. He claims that Laura was nowhere near Colton's apartment during the time that Jennifer was killed, and that there's no certain evidence that Laura participated in the dismemberment of Jennifer's body. Laura's DNA was found on three items. One of Jennifer's sandals found near the bathtub, a blue shop towel found on the coffee table, and the pistol that was used to shoot her.
Her DNA?
Yes.
Was his?
No. And I want to know how the hell, when the autopsy determines that her cause of death was a gunshot wound, how is it that that dude, he ends up getting convicted for murder, of course, and Laura does not. Really? And I want to know why. Why is this not drawn more attention to,
other than
because he said, I don't remember it, but I probably did shoot her. Because then I called, and they have those phone records where he called Laura at 3:30 a.m. and then again at 6 a.m. So,
and he didn't love Laura.
No.
She was a hookup.
Yeah.
He has no reason to protect her.
They
why wouldn't
bang
he,
buddies.
Why wouldn't he throw her under the bus? Unless he is so chivalrous that he took the fall.
I think that it's very possible that he did absolutely shoot Jennifer. And then we obviously know
but there's
Laura's
no...
DNA is on this pistol. She touched it last.
Yeah, she shot the
into
head.
Her head. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just because his
DNA what did she get found guilty of?
We'll get there.
Okay, because I'm listing off like mutilation of a corpse.
Yes,
and okay,
we get there.
Good.
Yep. There was also DNA recovered on a buck knife, a machete, and a hacksaw that was resting on top of Jennifer's body that matched only Colton and Jennifer. So it was Colton that was seen as the sociopath or the beast who destroyed, you know, everyone around him, who mutilated Jennifer's body. Now, for the prosecutors and the county assistant attorneys, Bill Bishop and Stephanie McFarland, it wasn't a straightforward case for them. They have this heinous murder, and they have two readily identifiable subjects, but the physical evidence was a bit confounding, and there wasn't, in their opinion, a clear motive to set aside for the jury. In Laura Hall's trial, prosecutors were left to develop a portrait of intent mainly through their conversations that Hall, who was 24, by the way, had with others in the months following the murder. they do bring some of that stuff in.
Like statements that she had made?
Yes, to a former cellmate when she was being housed in jail.
Love me a jailhouse confession.
I know. And I don't love this one. Henrietta Longenbach was held on a fraud charge. And then she testifies. I mean, she's held on being fraudulent, guys. That means lying. She's lying.
I'm smiling because there are very few things that you can bring up to hurt somebody's character, but one of them is a conviction for fraud.
Mm-hmm. Fraud, yeah. So Henrietta told the jury that during the 3 weeks that the two of them shared a cell, Laura made several incriminating statements about her involvement, including that she was actually in charge of the mutilation. She also said she was making statements that the reason that they were going to mutilate the body was to try to keep her body from being identifiable.
Oh.
That's what she was. And Colton did say it was her idea to dismember. And so I don't know that this is giving more evidence from things that Colton has already said. Like, yeah, she told me the list of things to get. It was her idea to dismember. And then we abandoned it and went to Mexico. And that was her idea as well.
What is wrong with Laura? Lori?
Laura.
What is wrong with Laura? That upon being called by your booty call, where he announces he's killed a girl... Your
the girl that you hate and you're jealous of.
But your first reaction is to go help him, law student. Please, for the love of Christ, call the cops.
There is just not.
How is this Colton guy worth this?
No.
Is he hot?
No.
Does he have a golden phallus?
No. And there's no phallus worth this. Ever.
Agreed.
Mm-mm. No, you can buy that on a shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zeus's phallus.
Yeah.
$14.99 comes with three extra batteries.
AdamandEve.com.
Right.
Sponsor
discreet
us.
Brown paper packaging.
Exactly. Oh, my thoughts exactly.
Wow.
This was the other thing that Henrietta testified about. That what bothered her is that Hall acted very blasé and said she did not understand, meaning Laura Hall, acted very blasé and didn't understand what the big fuss is about because all Jennifer Cave was a nothing, a nobody. What difference does it make?
She's a fucking sociopath.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. She's a psychopath.
I think so. This is what jealousy does when you hold on
to
that. And
no, it doesn't, Charnel. I've been jealous.
Oh.
Haven't you?
Of course, it's a natural human emotion.
Has it ever made you want to cut somebody's head off and shoot a bullet into it?
No, but I've never been that jealous before, right? Like, if you just don't, if you're not a healthy human being, you can let
this
stuff manifest. It just manifests itself into ugly, ugly, ugly. And that's what happened here. This is the other thing. Colton Petaniak's neighbor, Nora Sullivan, testified that Laura Hall told her that Colton had actually shot Jennifer, and then he sat in his living room drinking beer and watching TV instead of using the tools that he'd bought at the hardware store, and this really pissed Laura off that he was not motivated to get rid of the body, and get and like take care of this. And so that just bringing in that information is trying to show that Laura is making statements to people about her involvement in all of this and telling, telling a story of just like, yeah, we did end up, I was ticked off. He goes to the hardware store, he buys all this stuff, and then he sits down drinking beer, watching TV.
Eating pizza.
Yes, not caring. Not caring that people are knocking on the door looking for Jennifer. Not caring that her body is in the bathroom. In the tub, like, get to it, man. Yeah. That is the picture that this neighbor was painting. Like, yeah, when I talked to them, that's what she was saying. Like, this is how this escalated to that. He was sitting around.
Charnel.
Yes.
She was pissed with him sitting around as she's, please excuse how vulgar this is, hacking off Jennifer's head, grabs the gun and shoots it in the head to get his attention.
I agree.
I bet he got up and started helping after that.
Right.
That's oh God, it bothers me.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Mm-hmm. In the end, it unexpectedly took the jury 2 days to return the convictions. All right. So
it doesn't surprise me. That's a lot of evidence.
It is a lot. It is a lot to go through, and they have to really go. They really have to look at Laura's involvement. Was she the murderer? Was she not the murderer? Did she do the dismembering? Did she not do the dismembering? Because those are different charges, obviously, right? So what they do ultimately is they sentence her.
Do they have some type of accessory after the fact?
They bring her, yes, for essentially, yes. But then there is appeals and she gets dinged on mutilation. Dinged. She gets charged with the mutilation of the court. The initial jury.
Is she convicted
jury,
of mutilation?
Not in the initial.
Okay.
You know, in the initial one, she gets as many as 11 years of up to 11 years of incarceration. All right. He gets convicted of murder and he's sentenced to 55 years in prison. Okay. But he is eligible for parole.
In Texas? Mm-hmm. Texas likes to cook people. What's happening?
I know. Once he serves half of his sentence.
Oh my God. Do you think it was because he was so high on a bender he doesn't remember?
I wondered about that. Now in 2009, though, Laura appealed her conviction and at resentencing in 2010, the state gave her a harsher sentence because this is actually when they tacked on the mutilation of the corpse that was not originally a part. Like there more things came out in the resentencing that they determined.
Okay.
No.
So for that to have happened, they had to have had new evidence to charge her with the statute of limitations not running. And she couldn't have been convicted of something similar because jeopardy would have attached.
Right.
So otherwise that would be a double jeopardy situation. Mm-hmm. You can't take somebody back and say, you know what, I'm going to resentence you to this new crime because I have this new information or because I have this old information and we just messed it up before.
Also, Sharon's mother got a law passed. They were horrified to find out that at this time in the state of Texas, mutilation of a corpse was actually just a misdemeanor. So they went to their legislation and they got it changed and it's now a felony.
That is great. Do you know, let me give you some insight as to why that wouldn't have been a felony. Because originally when that type of statute was enacted, no one would have thought about someone mutilating like this. Mm-hmm. They would have been thinking about people digging up graves.
Yes.
So mutilation of a corpse would have been, not that this isn't awful and that you wouldn't be haunted probably for the rest of your life by whatever spirit you dug up.
Of course.
But digging up something in the graveyard and, you know, fucking around with it because people are well curious and gross, right? That's who we are. I don't think that it would have occurred to them that the mutilation would have been such as this. Yes. So to get it then changed to a felony because it now has a different legislative intent is amazing and beautiful that they were able to accomplish that.
God bless you. Thank you.
Or Kazuntai.
Oh, my gracious.
Or Begone Demons, whichever.
feels better.
Whichever you prefer.
Whichever one. Yeah. Well, either way, I feel great now.
Fantastic.
And I'm sorry that I sneezed on air. I'm not sure that I can edit that out even. So. And I hate to tell you guys, but she was released.
No. Mm-hmm. She served her time?
She served her time.
Yeah. Oh, is she our age?
She got a $16,000 fine. She's older than we are because she was 24 in...
Well, because Jennifer's your age.
Oh, yes. And Jennifer was 21 and she was 24.
So she's closer to my age.
Closer to your age, yes. Yep.
Walking about. Mm-hmm. Wonder if she's in law school.
She made parole in 2018. She was credited with time served. Mm-hmm. She hasn't popped up since, but Mr. Colton Petaniak is still imprisoned in the Robertson unit in the maximum security prison in Texas. And honestly, in the early 2030s, he'll be eligible for parole. Doesn't mean he'll get it. But
I have to say this is the one time I might be disappointed in Texas sentence.
I know.
I'm really usually a fan of those Texas sentences. They don't bullshit nothing.
I think a lot of it had to do with just what the prosecutors were saying about it being a very convoluted case, too.
I agree with them. I don't think anybody, I actually have no critical judgment over the prosecution in this case at all, because whether it seems open and shut or not, that is very difficult to prove when you have two clearly guilty people, but you don't know who did what.
Yeah.
And having to prove who did what is a matter of possibly both of them getting off.
Walking. Exactly.
The jury could have found both of them not guilty because one, different juries, different times. I mean, how fucked would that have been?
Right. Right.
So the fact that they got a murder one out of one of them and then the rest out of her, I guess. Better than nothing. It is. I hate to say that on a murder case, right. But better than nothing.
And realistically, I do think that Colton did the murdering and that she then was the mastermind afterwards. And
I'm just telling you that I think for some reason, and I guess, you know, let us know, listeners, part of murderers, I understand. I understand how they operate and why things happen. That mutilation afterward is just this level of
terror.
Terror. It's about terrifying. What a human is capable of. She is far scarier to me than he is. I agree. I'm just going to let you know.
I agree. Yep. And she wasn't under the influence of drugs.
No. And she's smart.
Yeah.
At least smart enough to get into law school. Mm-hmm. Not that we're all smart.
Let's be clear.
I have friends.
Right. Right. Oh my gosh.
Bathe me.
I'm
going to
bathe you just really quickly.
Okay. Spit bath.
Yes. Oh my God. That's hysterical. Yep. Just a quick little spit bath like your mama would give you when you had dirt on your cheek.
My mom calls that a PTA bath. Can guess what the PT and A stand
my
for.
My aunt calls it that too.
I know. Yes, old people are cool.
They are. Not that your mom's old. She's not old. She listens.
Oh, my grandma would call it that too.
Oh, okay. All right. Deputies arrest a woman accused of crashing weddings in 3 states. Mississippi authorities say that Sandra Lynn Henson is facing charges that include larceny, trespassing, and disturbing the peace. Yep. She apparently enjoys crashing several weddings throughout, where'd I say this was it? Mississippi. Right?
Mississippi.
Yep, Mississippi. Yeah, she was arrested at a wedding event over the weekend. This happened October 4th, 2023. They didn't immediately specify what happened, but they said that she was facing all of those charges of larceny, trespassing, and disturbing the peace. I wonder if she just got a little bit too tipsy there. She's been arrested in Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi for crashing other weddings as well. Honey, if you keep getting arrested, you're not real good at it. You need to stop.
I had this conversation earlier today about somebody who just steals, but he's got like, I don't know, 20 priors for stealing, and somebody's like... I feel like he's super dangerous. I'm like, really? Because he's not very good at it. Like,
he's going to get caught every time.
He's going to get caught. I mean, it's sad that people get their shit stolen, but he's clearly going to get caught and you're going to get your shit back.
Right, like, right. I'm
only half joking about him not being dangerous, but I'm just saying that, you know, that's that type of situation.
Yes, it is. Like, honey, you've been arrested in 4 states for this. You got to stop. Why?
It's kind of funny, though.
And she's older.
It's not funny if it's your wedding, though.
No, your special day. Although I have the type of sense of humor that I'd be like, Lynn, you want to stay? Pull up a chair. You know what?
But can you stop stealing from my cards from the gift table?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Stay away from those gifts. I'll give you a free meal. You can have a little bit of booze in ya.
Yeah. And flirt with the young fellas on the dance floor.
Absolutely. Take them for a spin out there. I don't care.
When I'm 80, I hope somebody tells me to take a groomsman for a spin. Hey, Megan, take that young little buck for a spin there. I'll be like, to the dance floor or the bedroom?
The one with the tight ass.
The one with the tight. I don't care about asses. It's all about arms for me.
Oh, I don't discriminate. I like them all.
Pretty faces, too.
For sure. All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Hope that you enjoyed this case as much as we can enjoy murder.
Sorry.
I know. Sorry. But that's why we do the brain baths.
You know,
we cleanse them kind of afterwards. So if we can use, I'm using the word cleanse very loosely.
Yes.
Very loosely. But regardless, hope that you have a good rest of your day. Thank you so much for supporting our show by listening. Feel free to join our Patreon. Get hundreds of extra content episodes that are waiting for you to just binge there. So,
and until next time,
yeah, keep it curious,
keep listening.
Bye-bye.